20
Great.
Minutes.
Great.
All right, we're done.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live. We're here on Block Talk Radio. All you independent, low-budget filmmakers, we're so excited to talk about the pioneering father of low-budget filmmaking, Ted V. Michaels. We're going to be with our guest, Kevin Scott Collier, who wrote the definitive authorized biography on Ted. We'll be back with him in about 30 seconds. And I want to welcome, I'm so honored to have as my Ed McMahon today, the associate producer of one of my all-time favorite films, The Haunted World of Ed Wood Jr., and who is a very brilliant man to ask questions on this subject of low-budget filmmaking, and Ted Michaels. So my co-host today is Al Doshna. Welcome, Al.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. Honored to be here.
Well, we're honored to have you. And we're going to be right back with Kevin Collier. And we have a bunch of special guests. Oh, my God. This may be the first time that a bunch of the stars of Ted's films are all talking in one place, because several of them, and I'm going to reserve these surprises for you, are going to be calling in today, several of the stars of Ted's films. So we'll be right back in about 30 seconds here at Richard Rossi Live.
Chief, you know, there's two things in this world I hate to miss. One's a Lakers game and the other's Rich Rossi Live. You got to be cuckoo to miss this show, you know what I mean, pal? And wait till you get a load of what Rich is going to talk about today.
Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live. And welcome, Kevin Scott Collier. Thank you for writing this book. And tell us, how did you get going on this journey to write the life and cinema of Ted V. Michaels? By the way, listeners, it's available on Amazon and anywhere books are sold. But what got you started on this journey?
Well, first, thanks, Richard, for having me on the program. It's great. Actually, it started out as an Astro Zombies book. I'm a fan of the Astro Zombies movies, well, all of Ted's movies. But in particular, I wanted to focus on the four Astro Zombies films. And I contacted Ted out of the blue in December 2015. And I thought, I can only do the book if I get him on board. And he responded back. And I was shocked. It was his own personal email. I thought, that's kind of weird. But he was responsive to it. But he started to suggest other films. He says, you know, I've made other movies, and maybe you've heard of them. And he started to drop these little hints that he would like a book about his whole career in all mm-hmm. his films. And I kind of found out that he had done a book previously. It came out in 2008 by another author. And it was a fine book, but it was overpriced, and he was concerned that his story hadn't got out to anybody. So I thought about it, and I talked with my wife, and I said, you know, this is going to be an enormous undertaking, because if I do it, I'm also going to have to, Ted would not know this, he'd find this out later, contact as many of the stars from the films dating all the way back to 1963 and try to get them on board to comment in the book. Now, we're talking several actors that are in the 70s, 80s, but I succeeded. In fact, I just got Gary Clark, and the book is going to be amended sometime soon to feature him. And he starred in Ted's first film, Strike Me Deadly, in 1963. So I'll be talking with him. I got Gary's phone number, and he's going to be added to the book. He's already in there, but not original content from Gary for the book. Mm. So that's how it started.
Your book is fantastic, and I really liked hearing the story about James McEachin, who is holding, and I hate to have James hold real long for us, but James, are you still on there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
James,
well, it was so interesting, I couldn't cut it off.
My wife and I just saw you on the Bionic Woman recently. A Bionic Woman rerun is
okay.
a training Lindsay Wagner, who's been a guest on our show and a friend of mine. Lindsay Wagner was on the show recently, but you, I remember when she trained to be a cop, and we saw it, and I said, I said, that's the Black Klansman, but if, according to Kevin's book, Ted pretty much gave you your first big shot as an actor, and you've had a very prolific career since. Am I remembering that right, Kevin and James?
Absolutely
correct.
That's
what James told me,
My very, very, very first to even thought about appearing as an actor. He did it.
And what was it like working with Ted, James?
Well, I think I was in a state of shock throughout that whole period because I had never wanted to be an actor, and I got to meet Ted through this fellow that had written this book, the screenplay, I'm sorry. And he wanted me to meet the producer, director. And I knew absolutely nothing about acting, didn't want to be an actor, had no thoughts or concerns about anything having to do with acting. And at any rate, he convinced me to go up and see this producer with this script because he was so anxious to get the script done because, like any writer, you know, you just want to try to get the thing on get it on the boards, so to speak. So he took me up to see Ted, and one thing led to another, and before you know it, I was in this film.
And you've been a prolific actor ever since. I've seen you on so many shows. You know, when we see reruns of Perry Mason or Matlock or Diagnosis Murder.
Yeah, well, I've been very, very lucky.
Yeah.
But it all started with Ted.
You've been everywhere.
If I hadn't met him that day on Melrose Avenue, then I never would have. I never would have thought about acting. I mean, it's
wow.
This is Kevin. James, I have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Now, when you made the Black Klansman, now James, remember, has been on every TV show, but this is your first film. And one of the moments I relay in the book that Ted Michaels told me about was when there was a cross-burning scene. Can you describe that for the audience? What happened when the police arrived and saw all the Klansmen with the hoods on?
Oh, God, that was funny. The thing about that is that the film was called I Cross the Color Line, and the storyline was that my friend, I was playing a musician, which I didn't know that until I got to the set that day, that evening. This fellow had made his way down to some parts of the South and to infiltrate the Klan because of his wife or something like that had some interest with those people. And at any rate, it was a bunch of Klansmen. And we were shooting in Bakersfield. And a state trooper, one of the highway patrolmen, rather, drove by, and he saw, looked over the ravine, and there were a bunch of Klansmen hanging this guy from the back of a truck, lynching him. And the state trooper, Ted Michaels, shooting on a total shoestring budget, forgot to notify the people that he was going to be there shooting this film, but there was a scene in there where he was going to be hanging somebody. So the highway patrolman, as he was driving by that night, looked down in the ravine. He saw this huge bonfire going, and these Klansmen shouting and saying all of these profane things. And the Klansmen couldn't believe. In Bakersfield, my town, the Ku Klux Klan rally. He jumps out of his car. He comes down and he's making his way on the set. And as he was doing it, he saw the generator operator, and this guy here was underpaid, and then his equipment wasn't half running. And he said, "What the hell's going on here?" And the guy said, "How the hell do I know they're lynching a bunch of colored people or whatever they're doing? Don't bother me." Of course, he was the guy was half drunk at the time, and so the cop told everybody to stop what you're doing. Take off them goddamn hoods. And he was screaming and carrying on. And he said, "What the hell is going on?" And Ted said, who's making all that noise over there? And it was the trooper shouting out these commands. But the thing that was so really interesting is that when the trooper had all the guys to take off the hoods, They were all black.
Wow, well, that was a big shock.
Yes, it was, because he hired them because, you know, they didn't make very much money. And so Ted was using the cheapest people he could find to play the scene. And
yeah, when you worked in the starring role, sometimes you had to be an extra, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's what it was. They were extras, yeah, yeah. So, it was something. And then to top the evening off, one of the guys stole the camera and took off. And the cops came by and they said, well, who all was on the picture? And so they told them the name of these, a lot of the local extras, the local guys around there. And they said, well, let's go by John Jones' place and pick up your thing, because he's a known thief. And you had him on the set and he stole the goddamn camera.
And in your book, Kevin talks about how Ted was just a master of just stealing shots and hightailing it out of there. And those of us that make independent films, we have to do this all the time. Even Hitchcock stole a shot with Cary Grant walking into a government building. And yet, you know, in the larger culture, you know, James, you went on to be in things that are in the mainstream, a lot of these shows. And Ted was had this unique genius, but it seemed like a lot of times his ideas didn't get into the larger culture unless someone co-opted them, like the whole Doll Squad, Charlie's Angels thing there, where Ted would talk about how he had that idea with the Doll Squad film, Francine York, and then Aaron Spelling has Charlie's Angels and even has one of the girls named Sabrina, and there's that big debate about did they take Ted's idea. But yet, you know, in your story, James, it shows that regardless of whether or not the larger culture always recognized his brilliance and his artistry, he still influenced so many people in your whole direction as an actor and influenced perhaps even some of our iconic shows like Charlie's Angels. So he had an influence that goes far beyond how many people knew about his life and cinema, didn't he?
Well, you also got to remember, at that time, I knew absolutely nothing about acting. I mean, most people would, you know, were fans of television or something like that, and that's where they would get some idea as to what you're supposed to do. I didn't know what you were supposed to do. For instance, I never knew until the moment I got on the set that you were supposed to memorize dialogue, which is, from that day to this day, has caused me problems with working, because I find it very difficult to learn dialogue, which is why I ad-lib a lot. But why Ted hired me, I don't know, because I certainly would have hired me, because I didn't, you know, I told him up front, I didn't know. But he thought my reluctance to get involved with the film was because I had some sort of a reputation of being a pretty good actor or something like that. But it wasn't true. I was just reluctant because I didn't know what the hell I was supposed to do when I got to the set. And the first day on the show, we drove. We had to drive from Los Angeles to Bakersfield to shoot the picture. And my friend who had gotten me involved was a guy by the name of Max Julian, who went on to star in a picture called The Max, which did very well, as a matter of fact. I went on to do 150 shows or something like that. I had my own show, and then working with Clint Eastwood as much as I have. But he was strictly responsible for that. He and the guy that wrote the screenplay, what I think of what you call the Black Klansman now, or whatever the name of it is today. But it was Ted V. Michaels who. In his office, said to me that I'm going to put you in this picture. Well, then when I left out of his office and went back home, my wife asked me something. I said, about where was I or something like that, and I told her what had happened. And then I forgot about it. And about 2 weeks later, Ted's office called me and said, and then Ted got on the phone and wanted to know about this script that he gave me. What was I going to do with it? What was I going to do it? Was I interested? And I had forgotten all about it. I had totally forgotten about it. And so he says, well, Well, the part is yours if you want it. And I said, I'll be down. That's how it's done.
Yeah, what's really cool, James, is Ted told me he really knew you were right for the part, and he really believed in you.
Well, he did, but the question is why? Because I thought that was what I did was one of the worst acting jobs. I remember at the premiere of the film, I was so embarrassed I got up and walked out of the theater. I didn't know, for instance, that you were supposed in close-ups that you aren't supposed to move around. How you have to repeat the dialogue and you do offstage lines. I knew absolutely nothing about that. Or, for instance, in driving the car in the scene that you aren't supposed to drive all the way down the road. You just move the car a few inches into the close-ups and all that. All of that stuff I knew nothing about and would never have ever gotten involved had it not been for Ted.
Well, you sure learned quick on the job, and I love your performance. You mentioned Clint Eastwood in Play Misty for Me as the DJ, and you certainly were natural.
Yeah.
That was natural because, once again, with that dialogue, Clint, when you work with Clint, you're allowed to do whatever you do. Well, you take it or... Because he isn't giving you very much, and you just have to depend on your own instincts. And that happened a lot. And that's why a lot of people started calling you back to doing these shows. I mean, with Duke Wayne and all of these people, it was interesting. But it was all chalked up to Ted's foresight.
Wow.
Yeah.
What an influence he had on you. I really like that period of the film, of Ted's work, the Black Klansman, and when he was shooting on film, Corpse Grinder, Doll Squad, Girl in Gold Boots, I really liked that period a lot when he was shooting on film. The video stuff, it's great that he kept going, and we have those films and like them as well, but there's something very magical to me about that whole period of his work. Do you have a favorite period of his work, Kevin, or James? I know he was very prolific. I mean, people compare him to Ed Wood, but he certainly made a lot more films. I think Ed Wood, and Al is our resident Ed Wood expert on the line here, but I think he made so much more films than Ed Wood. But what's your favorite period, Kevin, of Ted's work?
I like the 60s and into the late 70s. And in particular, his works from about 1997 until he passed away. And even when he went to digital and went to video, he still kept up the campiness, the props, and he brought in a whole new band of actors. And a lot of that was thanks to Rusty Myers, and included Donna Hamlin and Sean Morelli, and so there was a whole new generation, and that pretty much unfolded after he made his move from Los Angeles. And
the move from Los Angeles, by the way, Al's on the line. He just had lunch yesterday with a producer, Lucky Brown, who's been around forever and has known everyone, and Al was telling us that Ted called Lucky and said, I just left L.A., and Lucky was shocked. He said he got out of town so quick he thought Ted was just a fixture here, and he left behind some lights and equipment for Lucky to pick up at his studio, huh, Al?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Yes. Also, getting back to the acting, I think sometimes directors can see a rawness in an actor's quality that actors that are more heavily trained lose that naturalness, but sometimes an actor is his own worst enemy or critic, so I think that's what comes across.
That's what he saw
actors.
In James.
Yeah, James, right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Do you have a question for Kevin or James, Al?
Right, well, for Kevin, for Ed Wood fans, it's kind of interesting that by the time he worked with Ted, which was on Orgy of the Dead, Ed Wood had done his major films like Plan 9 and Bride of the Monster. But from what I understand, Ted didn't really remember much about working with Ed on Orgy of the Dead. But at some point, he obviously learned more about him and used Dolores Fuller in Corpse Grinders 2. Did he have any particular reaction, or what was his what were his thoughts on Ed Wood as he became more well known?
Not a lot. He didn't comment a lot about Ed Wood, and I got the gist that he didn't like a comparison of it because the two were so different. And well, they were. And but Ed Wood, he only recognized Ed Wood from a photograph after he had been on that film shoot you're talking about. He did the lighting there and some other things. He mainly hung out with Criswell, and they, because they both liked magic, and they talked a lot about magic, you know, during the breaks. But he recognized Ed Wood in a picture later, a photograph of Ed. But somebody said, well, this is Ed Wood. And he says, oh, yeah, I worked with him. That's him. So he didn't even, he was in the peripheral. He was just strolling around the set once in a while, and I'm not sure even Ted met him on the making of the movie. So, Ed Wood. Yeah.
How did he meet Joe Solomon?
Oh. Now, who is Joe Solomon?
That was a producer of The Black Klansman, or I Cross the Color Line, whatever it was.
I can actually look that up. Let me see.
And what, how many films had he made that, before starting on this, the Black Klansman, or I Cross the Color Line, as it was originally called?
Ted had done quite a few films. Well, actually a couple. He did Strike Me Deadly in 63, The Dr. Sex in 64. One Shocking Moment, that was with, that was just before the Black Klansman. So 1966 was Black. So he had made three theatrical films before he worked on the Black Klansman. And only one of those four films was in color. That was Dr. Sex.
Mm-hmm.
So
in the time period of Black Klansman being 66, a lot of people today don't put this in context, but you know, Martin Luther King Jr., I believe, was assassinated 68. This was right at the height of the fight for civil rights, and so this was pretty gutsy for you, James and Ted, to make this film at this time.
Well, but I, please don't remember, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I wasn't a showbiz type of a guy. I mean, I was in the music business, but I didn't know anything about acting. I didn't know what a director really did. I mean, here you hear it all the time because of the many channels that we have at Beaches, entertainers or entertainment.
Now, James,
but
in my book,
I didn't want to be an actor.
Yeah, in my book, you mentioned Joe Solomon. He didn't say to me for the book how he met him, but he does. There is a quote in here of Ted. He said, the fact that I actually made the movie The Black Klansman during these events that were taking place in the Los Angeles area has been fascinating to many people, Michael said. We were not sure of how it would be received, the movie. When I made the movie, I told my executive producer, Joe Solomon, that I would not make any movie that added to racial difficulties but resolved racial tension. That's what he had to say about Joe regarding the movie.
Interesting. I wish I had spent
quote
more time
that Ted,
with
Ted
Ed.
Gave. This is, Ted said it took his heart, his entrails to make a movie, and at the end of his life, and it's quoted in your book, Kevin, he said, I wish I was immortal on this earth to keep on my quest to make another great movie. And he really gave his heart to it. He did it for the love of it, didn't he?
He did. He, in a way, I imagine that Ted thought that he could become immortal simply if he had another movie in production, because he couldn't leave until he finished it. But unfortunately, his last film, he did realize that 10 Violent Women Part 2, that Donna was in, that he was not going to be able to complete the film. But Drew Marbick, who was a person that worked in several of Ted's movies and has his own movie out too, he's committed to finishing the editing on that final film, Ten Violent Women 2. And he told me that he probably will have it finished the end of this year.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that he didn't drift over into the more mainstream type of films?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, James.
I think Ted just liked the quirkiness of it all. He liked to be an entertainer. From the time he was a little boy, he was into the magic and into the tricks, and he'd shoot beans out of his nose. And so he was a showman. And the mainstream just did not appeal to him that much. He wanted something a little quirky, something that was different. And it was an artistic way of him doing it, too. And I think that's why he never went mainstream, because it was going to be a sellout to him. But he tried to make movies that were mainstream because, you know, a good example is The Doll Squad, which Aaron Spelling took the idea for after Tura Santana gave him a print of the film and came up with the Charlie's Angels, including using the name Sabrina when Francine York went in to audition for the TV series. Like Francine said, he had the gall to steal the name, and then he tipped the whole idea. So Ted did experiment with some mainstream stuff, but other people, like, you know, you said, Richie, earlier, they would take his ideas and reinvent them into something else.
Yeah.
Well, you also write about him being...
I'm not in the Directors Guild, not in any guild. I just don't want anyone telling me what to do or what I can not do.
So that's a kind of a control thing also.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the showman side, I love the promotion, and William Castle, of course, did the same with the nurses in the lobby, taking the pulse to make sure they can handle the shock. And, you know, as an independent filmmaker myself, my last film was about my boyhood hero, Roberto Clemente, and we did all kind of event screenings at these art house theaters, and everyone wore Clemente 21 jerseys, and it was a huge event type of thing. And movies now, they go streaming right away, or they're on Amazon or Netflix right away, and I think we're missing some of that whole showman thing that of having the event of a movie. In fact, my current film, it might be old school, but I want to delay it on DVD and streaming. I like that thing of the Ted Michaels thing of going to theater to theater and having a real event, and I think he liked that whole type of thing where he would he had the independent theater owners, as you know, have a competition of who could build the best corpse grinding machine back in the day.
Yes, and he had for corpse grinders, which really was the money spot for Ted. It was when one of his films had a big commercial aspect to it, and it did really well. And he had promotions outside of theaters. The Girl in Gold Boots came just before a film or two before that, and Leslie McRae went with him touring around the country. So there was actually...
Well, speaking of Leslie McRae, you are psychic, Kevin. Speaking of Leslie McRae, as you said the name Leslie McRae, she popped up on line 4. Leslie, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Wow. So Kevin was just saying you went on a tour with the Girl in Gold Boots, and by the way, you're so adorable in that film.
Great.
What was that like, just the promotion side, when you're going from theater to theater?
Well, first of all, I turned 21 on the set.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really fun. And I was really a big part of putting the film together, which was really exciting for a youngster. And then when we toured to the United States, we got amazing rave reviews wherever we went. People just loved it. It was, you know, kind of an Anne Margaret, Elvis Presley kind of picture. And it was very, very exciting to get the key to all the cities. And the mayors loved us. So it was just, he's an amazing guy. I practically grew up with he and his family, Ted Michaels.
Do you think, Leslie, I mentioned a moment ago, it feels like we're losing some of that really cool event feeling. I remember as a kid, you'd go to the theater. It was such a big thing. You know, if they had a Christmas movie about Santa Claus, Santa would be in a Santa suit and greet you at the door. And now kids can watch it anytime. You know, the Disney movies, they would come out every 6 or 7 years, and we'd be so excited. Snow White's in the theater again, and, you know. But now they can watch it anytime on their phone or on their laptop. And it seems like that whole experience you had where you would go to the city and get the key,
that's something that is so special. And I don't know, is it just me, or do you feel like we're missing that a little bit today?
I do. I think the Big Star era was very exciting, and I think that we created our celebrities so that people really knew them and loved them and forgave them. So today's commerciality with you can reach anything on the internet, or I mean, pictures of me keep popping up I've never seen before. So anyway, I agree. It was a really nice family unit. He had many children. And so he would go out and buy a big steak, and he'd hammer it with a hammer and garlic and all that, and everybody ate together and made spaghetti, and it was a really nice family affair, even though he did a lot of horror films, in which I was in Blood Orgy of the She-Devil. It was fun.
That was great.
Yeah, that was the one shot at the castle with the whole satanic vibe, wasn't it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. He actually lived in a castle.
You know, I know you don't want to focus on it too much, Kevin, because it's become kind of this legendary thing about the castle and all the women, and they say he had a harem. But
no,
I get
that's
the feeling it was more of a family. It was more of a wholesome thing than just like making it out like it was some sort of free love cult or something. It was more of a communal thing where they worked on films together. But what's
absolutely.
Your take on that, everyone?
Well, the castle, Leslie said, you would have dinners there, you would meet there. It was Ted, throughout his whole career, everyone I interviewed, 50 people for this book that starred in this film, all said that we were family. We gathered, we ate together, we hung out. I mean, and that's pretty amazing when you're going through 60 years of films. You know, Leslie can tell you more.
Well, it also was not, it was not a big union kind of thing in those days, so we all lifted the lights and we moved the microphones around, and it was, just everybody chipped in. It was really family films, and that's what made films more glamorous in those days, I think, too.
Well, there's a serendipity to the way everyone's calling in. We're talking about the castle, and I notice on line 6, we have Kevin Michaels, who brought Ted to even greater fame in the mainstream with his documentary Wild World.
Yeah.
Kevin, you're on at 3106, starting with a 6 there. Are you on, Kevin?
That's right. That's right,
Kevin,
Richard.
You
How
actually
you
did,
hey,
I, didn't you take Ted Michaels back to the castle years later and film him wandering around and remembering shooting with Leslie there and everything?
I think
you actually took him back there,
did.
Didn't you?
Yeah, we absolutely did, and it was owned by Disney executives.
Really?
Strangely enough. Two producers, a husband and wife team that were producers on Pirates of the Caribbean. So that was pretty neat to see that. And we had Ted run up and down the stairs and check out all the renovations they had made. But one of the things that they didn't understand was, they were like, wow, we finished up your wine cellar. And he didn't want to tell them that it was an S&M dungeon that he was planning back there.
He actually had real sounds coming out of the dungeon, screams and things like that. It was really fun.
Wow.
So they made it into a wine cellar.
What got you interested? We have two Kevins, Kevin Scott Collier that wrote the book, and Kevin Michaels, who did the documentary on Ted.
Excellent documentary.
Yeah. I asked Kevin Collier about what drove him to make the book. What interested you, Kevin, and also, our mutual friend Alexia, who works with you. You've done so many great films, Kevin, on David Lynch and other filmmakers. What drove you, or how did you decide to do the project, The Wild World of Ted Michaels?
Well, I wanted to learn filmmaking. You know, working with Ted, as you guys mentioned, is very communal family style, and he just loved to teach people, loved to show people the technique, and he showed me how to edit 35mm film, which is quite antiquated at this point, but he said, you really can't go onto a Macintosh before you know how to cut film and how to pull a piece of film out and know how long a reaction shot is, which was the length of Ted's arm. He would just pull a piece of film out and cut it. and that was your reaction shot. So that's the physical part of it. And also he showed me the, you know, how you put sound effects in. Everything was a physical piece of celluloid. So you would you'd literally assemble it. You know, it was very much a lot of physicality was used.
Yeah, you got that tactile
experience. And it really taught
experience.
Me how to use the Final Cut, yeah.
Yeah, you know, one technique that you showed in that documentary, and our mutual friend Alexia was featured doing this with Ted under his instruction, he had a technique of cutting in the camera where he had the actors, and then he would say, cut, freeze, and the actors would kind of freeze like a statue, then he'd move over and get the other cut. And in a matter of just jumping around getting these different shots, he had a piece then that he could just take the pauses out, and it was a fully cut piece. I thought that was a really – and it's a great technique for an independent filmmaker if they get your documentary. By the way, you can get The Life and Cinema of Ted V. Michaels, the book with Kevin Scott Collier, and, of course, Kevin Michaels' documentary Wild World of Ted Michaels on Amazon or wherever you get these things. But I thought that cutting in camera was a brilliant technique, and I've used it myself when we – you know, are stealing a shot and have to get in and get out of a location. I thought it was, you know, simple, but a very brilliant technique.
That's right, Richard. It's very interesting because he was using, you know, short ends in these cameras. So by the time the camera comes up to speed, you might be out of film. Sound like video. People don't understand this today.
Yeah. By the way, just joining us from Vegas, I'm guessing that this might be Donna Hamblin. Is this you, Donna, at 702-204?
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks
Donna,
for inviting me.
You're so beautiful, Donna, is that woman in black and one of his last ones that we have and saw the paranormal text messages from the dead. And Donna... Donna Lee, who's a friend of mine and acting in a film I'm shooting right now. And I want to thank you, Donna, how you took care of Ted and Kevin Collier in your book. It's one of the most beautiful parts to me because you can't judge a book by its cover because you see in the films, Donna, you're this, you know, exotic beauty, kick-ass woman, and yet you were so nurturing and kind in the way that you ministered to Ted and took care of him at the end when he was getting sick before he left us for heaven. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being such a nurse to him and a friend to him at the end like that.
Oh, you just made me have goosebumps. That meant so much to me, what you just said. And I wasn't the only one taking care of him, but I aided in his care. I would go over there Friday through Sunday, but you know, I have that nurturing capability anyway. It's been with me all my life, but with somebody like Ted or whoever I have to help, especially with him, he was like a father to me. It came natural, and it was, I always tell people that the most fulfilling time you could spend with somebody is taking care of them and nurturing them. And he allowed me to do that, and he very much appreciated it. I wouldn't give that up for anything. So filming with him and then going through the end like that was just an amazing experience in my life, and I have wonderful memories from it.
And you're the star of one of the stars of the very, very last film, right, that he was working on when he passed?
I am, 10 Violent Women, Part 2. Francine York was billed to be the star of the movie, and at the time Ted had called me because she was ill, and we kind of kept that secret, you know, from the public. She didn't want people to know, and he asked me if I could step in a few weeks before we filmed. So I said, "Okay, sure, I'll give it a shot."
Yeah,
you
Francine
know?
Was a friend of mine. We met at I made a film about Amy Simple McPherson that won an award, and she was at the awards thing, and we became buddies. And she had this irreverent kind of way of just spitting out her opinion in very strong terms, and we both had a very dark sense of humor about the whole awards event, and we were kind of doing almost like a Mystery Science Theater, making fun of the whole awards event as we were being given these awards, and she was such a lovely person, and it's so interesting that her and Ted both passed very close to each other, didn't they?
Absolutely, yeah. It was, I think, within, what, 2 months of each other?
2 or 3
she
months.
Had called
yeah.
Ted just a few weeks before Ted passed away. He listened to all his conversations on speakerphone really loud, so, of course, anybody near could hear. But I think she was working on her own documentary. Somebody, what, I don't remember, but she had questions for him. And, yeah, I heard through the grapevine that she was sick and through Ted, but I didn't really know. But she was opinionated, and she didn't have a problem blurting it out. But sometimes you have to respect people like that. You
yeah.
know? You can't call
she
her
was,
a phony,
she was
sure.
a doll. She was a doll from the doll squad. This phone lines, I tell you, this is a tribute to how much Ted is loved. I mean, these phone lines are lighting up like a Christmas tree. On line 10, we have someone at area code 435, first three numbers 586. Who is it, area code 435? You're live. Who is that?
Lonnie Silverman.
Hi, Lonnie. Uh-huh. And what do you want to say about Ted Michaels today?
Tourist daughter.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Hi, Lonnie.
Hi, honey. How you doing?
I'm great. It's good to hear your voice.
Yeah, miss you, darling.
I know, you too.
Well, just wanted to call and say how much I loved him and loved him since I was a little girl. I think the very first time my mom said I ever met him, I was like maybe 18 months old and on her shoulder. So, and I've grown up with Ted my whole life.
What's some
literally
of your favorite memories,
kind of
Lonnie?
Grew up with his kids.
Well, Lonnie, you actually had a small role, this is Kevin Collier, in Ted's 10 Violent Women, the original film.
Yes, I did.
People don't know that.
Some
and
people
also, I don't know if it was announced, but Lonnie's mother was the famous Tura Satana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, and you're in the final 10 Violent Women 2 brandishing a firearm. I think there's a picture of that in Kevin's book, or am I mistaken?
That was, I believe, in the first one, but the second
yeah.
one, I'm just an audience member appreciating a fine performance.
Wonderful. Wow. Well, you have so many memories. James McEachin asked a very poignant question earlier, and now we have about a dozen of you on the line to weigh in, and it is a big question, and James McEachin, star of Black Klansman, asked, why did Ted stay in his independent world rather than more mainstream world? And some of the answers that we've come up with thus far is he liked the control and the quirkiness of doing what he liked to do his way, Kevin Collier said. And I mentioned the fact of the having the control as a showman to do the events and the, you know, the promotions the way he wanted. And yet a lot of his ideas did get co-opted, is a kind way of saying it. You know, stolen would be how Francine would say it with Doll Squad and Charlie's Angels. But what are some of your thoughts about why Ted never went mainstream or in the larger culture, and he kept doing it his way? Anybody?
That would definitely be because, unfortunately, I wish my daughter were on the line right now, because Danae worked with Ted. She actually worked with him on the Slave Apartheid movie, and she was his videographer, and he ended up giving her assistant director credit because of the fact that she understood his vision, and she saw things, and she knew how to interpret things that Ted said and how he wanted to see it very well. She had very good instincts, and she followed a lot of his lead. I believe, at least in my growing up with Ted and watching him behind the scenes and doing, I mean, I'd sit there in the editing room with him for hours and hours and hours. Control is kind of an awkward term to say or to use when it has to do with it, but yes, I think that Ted was unwilling to turn over the kind of control because he had such an eye for detail and such an eye for so many different things that when he's in the editing room, he wants it to tell the right story and tell it the right way. So he pieces things together in a way so his vision is interpreted correctly.
That makes a lot of sense because the editing is really where the final film is made, even as much or more so than production. The post-production is what you're putting together, what will be the final story. And
exactly.
In a mainstream studio, he'd have to give that over to the studio and the committee, and very few people get that kind of final cut if he was in a larger environment.
Oh, absolutely. And he had lots of offers for mainstream studios to take over different films and things like that, people that were interested in different stories of his. And he didn't want to lose that interpretive control, I guess you'd say.
Well, that's a true artist, I think, because Orson Welles, even at the end, struggled. Here he is voted greatest director of all time, and no one will give him money because he wants control. And now here we are, the other side of the wind. Hopefully Netflix says they're bringing it out this year, and it was done shooting in the 70s. But here's Orson Welles, the same thing. He said, look, I got so many years left. I'm not going to waste my time, you know, making somebody else's story. I want complete control of what I'm doing.
Exactly. Well, because you can only interpret it, you know, and you can only show your vision of that interpretation when you can control the editing, control the filming, control, you know, and it's kind of a bad term to try and say because people misinterpret it. He wasn't that kind of a control freak because Ted was more than willing to actually share vision. And when my daughter was working with him, any input that she gave him, he listened to, and he'd let her film it her way and his way, and then some of her stuff made it into the final cut, you know, because he said, nope, you're right, that was better.
So was there one of his projects that somebody wanted to do a bigger budget version of that you'd think of offhand?
Well, I know Richard, early on in his movie career, he always had problems with people that wanted to be investors. He told me that, you know, they wanted to give him money and this. But he knew that once he did that, he would be beholden to them, and they would kind of be making the film. And he a lot of times dodged out of those situations. You know, a lot of what he said to me too was, this could have been bigger. This movie could have gone somewhere, but I wasn't going to sell out to them. I wasn't going to let them gain control or buy me or take it over. So he was an independent filmmaker to the fullest degree.
Yeah, I just like to add into this that, you know, he had watched Roger Corman go through all those things and lose control. So that it happens a lot, just to chime in on what Lonnie was saying. But in the old days, you know, there was a distribution channel where you could make your films and you could actually show them and actually make a profit and control your own prints and posters and so forth.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting towards the end that he flowed into our modern social media way of doing things, raising money online, making the pitch on Indiegogo and things like that. So, you know, in some ways, I think, you know, it's sad in a way he couldn't continue shooting on film and doing some of the things he did in the early days. But I think he was very adaptable to the new digital technology and raising money online. And I think in many ways, going right to the people and getting money. And I think some of the freedom we have now with social media and raising funds with crowdfunding, I think in many ways that kind of fits Ted Michaels. Had he been able to be with us longer, I think the whole crowdfunding would have served him very well.
Well, you know,
absolutely.
Kevin Michaels would know this. Kevin Michaels would know this for sure. On the documentary, many of you people that work with Ted too, is he had to adapt from film to digital over his 60 years. And the Lesters, Gary Lester and Richard helped him with some of that. A lot of other people helped him. But, you know, this is a guy that was shooting on film. And then one thing that struck me about writing the book was how many times he would invest in new equipment and then say, and it became obsolete. You know, he would always,
oh, yeah.
Like, the word obsolete came up so often. It was like, and he would spend, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars, and tens of thousands on equipment, and only to have them a year or two later not be compatible with what needed to be done. And he would say, I couldn't even give the equipment away.
Mm.
So, you know,
yeah.
That is an incredible cost. But it was, Kevin would know this, too, because,
yeah,
you know,
you
really
could see
yeah.
Yeah, you can see in the documentary, you can see Ted's edit bay. What he would just do is he would just put a new piece of equipment in front of the old piece of equipment. So you could literally go back and back and back into the Jurassic Age.
I'm going to chime in here, Kevin, because when you shot the documentary in his studio, remember all that film equipment and cameras and whatnot that he, I mean, they were bigger than life itself. And they were just sitting there collecting dust, and he said he couldn't even give them away.
I
was
amazed. Even the Mitchell. The Mitchell was a dinosaur, and he couldn't even sell it to anybody. Yeah, yeah.
No, no.
And then he moved everything back to his house, and everything was under a tarp. He just stored it all. So,
yeah.
I don't know what happened to all that stuff.
Was
but,
he a bit of a pack
boy,
rat?
He had great equipment. Very much so.
Yeah, he was.
Well, you
but
know,
he,
the equipment changes
movie,
so fast. I remember when I started making films myself, you know, 10, 15 years ago, the XL1 was the Canon XL1. I remember we were all obsessed. We had to have a Canon XL1, and now when people see my Canon XL1, they're like, you know, this is a real dinosaur. It's not high def. It's not a Canon, you know. But how much more Ted Michaels? I mean, getting the short ends of film and... But yet he, what was it about that kept him going? Because, you know, even some of the great filmmakers of our time, Kevin, you've done a film on David Lynch, who I adore, great, great artist. But prior to his new Twin Peaks revival, I think, and I could be wrong, but I think his last film before that was Inland Empire, and he maybe has a dozen features out. But Ted just... kept cranking them out at such a almost manic pace for like 60 years. I mean, what do you all think kept him so prolific and kept him going like that in comparison to other guys who kind of lose their steam for a while?
Yeah.
Passion.
Yeah, he
pure passion.
Yeah, sheer passion.
Two weeks.
Moxie.
2 weeks before Ted passed away, he was, you know, pretty much immobile. And he had me getting out paper, writing out a shot list for 10 Violent Women Part 2 for the ending, and who's he wants this and this, and planning his next, you know, two movies. This is 2 weeks before he passed away. He said, I want to still make movies. I want to keep making movies. This was clear up until the very end for him. This is what was on his mind, and because of his passion for it.
Was there a particular role model that he modeled himself after, whether filmmaker or otherwise?
I don't, not that I'm aware of. Kevin may have
not
different
information.
Not that
he ever told me. Yeah.
I'm going
I
to have
think
to bow
he
out.
Wanted
this
to be
is
it.
Leslie McCray. I'm going to have to bow out, and he was
well,
one of
you,
a kind.
Well, thank you, Leslie. Leslie, since you're bowing
Bye,
out,
Leslie.
Why don't you share your final word on Ted, anything you want to leave our audience with?
Yeah, there was no one like him. He was one of a kind, and he was one of the happiest producers. He produced one a year his whole life, so that was pretty cool.
Thank you.
Well, God bless
God
you,
bless.
Leslie. Thank you for joining us. And that was Leslie McCray bowing out, and we're so grateful that she was able to join us.
Well, one thing that I was constantly amused with writing the book with Ted was the precarious situations he got into, constantly putting his actors into certain roles or situations and all kinds of weird things like that. Like, Donna, you were asked at the end of a long shoot to put on an Astro Zombie costume and come out of a clone booth.
And
I
did.
I'm a trooper.
Yes, she is.
And it was like 120 degrees in that studio. I was dying. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was typical, Ted. Whatever he needed, if it was within arm's reach, okay, that's good. You. This is our new phone. And, yeah, that was typical,
did he,
Ted.
Yeah, if you remember him getting busted,
Don,
shooting without a permit, any legal stuff or near arrests where the cops say, you can't shoot here. What are you doing? I know the James McEachin shared a really great story about they thought there was a real Klansman meeting. Did the cops ever come down on him, you know, about any of his shoots?
Well, on 9/11 they did.
Oh, that's right, they did. I wasn't on that set, but you're right, they did, because the airport, right, Kevin?
They had the zombies running around the airport on 9/11 with machetes, and the cops showed up. That was when the Twin Towers got hit.
This is Lonnie again. I just wanted to say, Kevin, don't you remember Ted telling you he incorporated the officers into the film?
That's great.
How he got away with it.
Yes, because he sometimes would shoot things and then hide it away. He'd hide the camera. Now, he did that with the original Aster Zombies movie in 1968.
Right.
You've seen at the end where the cops pull up in the cop cars. That was actually cops pulling up to a scene that they were shooting earlier in the film.
Was.
And he used it at the end of the film. Like, the police were arriving at this Dr. Septimus DeMarco's mansion. So, yeah, he did a lot. And Sherry Vernon almost got burned alive when they made the Blood Orgy of the She-Devils. She told me that, you know, they set the fire and the wind took off, and she was, like, going to be burned at the stake for being a witch. And she said, I almost burned at the stake.
Sherry.
For real.
Which film did he use the cops pulling up again? That title was a little – when the phone went out for a moment. What film was that where the cops were pulling up and he used it in the film?
The end of the original Astro Zombies film in 1968. There's cop cars that pull up outside of DeMarco's house, you know, where it's got John Carradine in the movie, in Turo.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yep.
And it's the last scene, and it shows cops pulling up. Well, that actually happened earlier when they shot the scene where the car is down the side of the hill, and I forget the name of the actor that played the Igor part. He drags a body out of the car, and they bring it back to DeMarco's place to turn it into an Astro Zombie. But he had a junk car on the side of a hill, which looked like it was an accident victim. There was somebody dead down there. It was William Bagdad. William Bagdad. He played a character in there, and he takes the body out of there. And Ted did this a lot of times, a lot of things. You know, Francine York went through a lot of situations. You did, Donna. A lot of other people did. Where a little dangerous.
And
Ted would talk about these, and if they were serious situations, he would still be dead serious about it. And if they were a little humorous, he would chuckle afterwards. And he used to always say, Donna, my movies are campy, but that's why people love them, and this is why I do it.
Well, you low budget filmmakers, you are learning the tricks of the trade. Why rent a cop car? Why rent cop uniforms? You know, why try to hire extras from central casting to play cops? Just, find us where the cops are really showing up and get your, even if you have to use your cell phone, if you're not allowed to use your camera, this is how you get production value, right?
So do you do?
Yeah.
Ted doesn't call cut just because live action is happening.
You're right.
He sits there and he'll keep filming it, and he got authorization from each of those officers to use them in the film.
Well, he was so nice and lovely. Who could really say no to that guy?
I know.
Well, that's a
he
big
had,
part of
like
success,
I said, he
just,
had
just
drive and he had visions,
over.
And that man hardly slept, you know? He would not sleep for more than a couple hours if you could get him to stop long enough.
Yes.
And then, of course, back in the day, and I remember this vividly because, of course, me being kind of a little kid at the time, he used to do those push-ups and sit-ups every day. And I mean literally thousands of push-ups and sit-ups every day. And I'd be sitting on his back while he was doing it.
Well,
he was
pretty
buffed
out. He was
quite
a bodybuilder back in the day. Well, for our closing, why don't we have each of you just share your closing thoughts on Ted. I think, James, you've been waiting the longest. Maybe James McEachin, can you still hear me? Are you still with us?
Yeah, I'd just like to say that someone just mentioned that Ted, that he was a nice man. He was indeed a very, very nice and a very generous guy. And I'm terribly sorry I never got the chance to thank him properly for what he did for me. To pluck a guy from off the street and then to put him in a movie, someone who didn't really want to be in a movie and knew nothing about the game, was really kind of something special. I did happen to see him at a restaurant one time on Ventura Boulevard here in Los Angeles, and we tossed a few. But if you go back to think about how nervy it is to hire someone who didn't even know that you weren't supposed to move on camera and to try to give that guy some direction. That's for instance, I was a basketball player in the picture. And he was telling me how to rub on the saxophone and all that stuff there. And I was afraid to do it because, you know, when you have your picture taken, you don't move. But this was acting. And he taught me that. So, Ted, God bless you.
Yes, God bless you, Ted. And God bless you, James, for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And what? How about maybe we'll leave you as the author with the final word. So let's go to we'll wait for you last, Kevin, since we're profiling your book. But how about Kevin Michaels? You made such a great film about him. What would be your closing thoughts on Ted Michaels?
Oh, gosh, I just miss him. I miss him so much. I love the way he would always call me Kevin Shawn Michaels and talk backward. And he taught me so much. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful for the guy. We just had so many great times with so many wonderful martinis. He knew how to make a great martini. He was just a wizard. So God bless him. I second that for sure. And thank you so much.
So beautiful. And thank you for calling in today, Kevin, and your film. By the way, those of you who want to see a great documentary, it has a lot of extras on it, too. He takes Ted back to the castle. The technique, I mentioned some of his techniques of filmmaking, the cutting in camera that our friend Alexia does in a little castle set there.
Yeah, you can watch it online. You can watch it on Amazon Prime right now.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Streaming. Yeah.
Great. Well,
thanks
you for
so
joining us. And
thanks
Kevin,
so much,
is it an accident because you make horror films, is it an accident that the first three numbers of your phone number are 666, or was that intentional?
To the gods over at AT&T.
That was just AT&T, huh? Okay. Well, it's a perfect number because you make such great, you've done such great stuff profiling horror. So, well, thanks for joining us,
thanks
Kevin.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
And how about there in Vegas, Donna Hamblin? Of course, you were there at the end as well as acting in his films. What would be your final words on the great legend, Ted Michaels?
Well, speaking of the backward talking, I was always Hannah Donna Hamblin. But this is how he addressed me. But my thing is I want to say how grateful I am for you, Richard, you, Scott, and Kevin Michaels that have paid such beautiful, beautiful tribute to Ted V. Michaels. A lot of people only know him as a producer. Many of us got to know him on a personal level and had beautiful relationships with him. But he had such an amazing, beautiful soul inside of him. And I'm glad that this has a lot to pay tribute to, not only his filming and all that he's done in the filming industry, but to show what a gracious person that he was. And I think that was done all here today. And because of everybody bringing light and Lonnie, she grew up with him.
I know.
So I just think it's so amazing. And my heart is so full of joy because I feel like this really has done Ted justice. And I just want to thank you. And I thank Ted time and time again. He's the one that really brought me out in this industry. I had no idea who he was when I started. I soon found out, but just anytime I just picture him or think of any of his, it just brings joy to me. And it's nice that you can go through life and have that feeling just thinking about someone. And thank you so much for inviting me to this show. It has meant the world to me.
Well, we're
so
grateful you're here, Donna. And, you know, this has been a wonderful thing. It wasn't all that planned out, but it's almost like, you know, a funeral or a memorial, how people you haven't seen for years all come back. And to have, you know, all of you together on the same show, James McEachin from the Black Klansman and Leslie McRae, the girl in gold boots, and you, Donna, and Lonnie, and the two Kevins, and Al. I mean, this has been like a memorial. And the great thing is, by the way, this link, this show, many are listening live across the world, but this link is good in perpetuity for people to revisit and hear this kind of living memories of him. And just all of you calling in has just been so wonderful. And how about you, Lonnie? Could you share with us your final thoughts?
I can't have final thoughts about Ted. Ted is forever. And Ted, I can't even begin to tell you how much he meant to me and Mom and my sisters and my niece and my daughter. And he was as much a part of our family and we his as could possibly be. And I loved him dearly from way back when I was a little teeny girl and growing up amongst his family and his daughters with him and his sons. And, you know, Teddy and Troy were like my own brothers. And, you know, like I said, Ted gave me away at my wedding, my last wedding. So, you know, he stood in for my dad because, you know, it's just one of those things where I can't even begin to tell you the impact. And even I was talking to his daughter, Charisse, just recently, and one of the things we talked about was the fact that I really, really miss Ted calling. Because he used to call all the time on holidays and wish me happy Valentine's and happy St. Patrick's and happy Easter and Merry Christmas. And, you know, and I used to look forward to those calls all the time, every holiday, every year. And, you know, there was such love in that man's heart and such vision in his mind and such a dynamic and dominating spirit as far as, like I said, he hardly slept and he would just work and work and work. And I spent hours and hours just in awe of him, you know, watching him work. And, you know, we were such good friends and family that we shared so much, you know. And because of that, I've met wonderful people like Don, like Kevin, like, you know, all these people that have worked in several of the movies, you know, Francine, God bless her, since she's passed on. And, you know, I can't believe Ted's not here anymore. Because
I hope in spirit form he hears this show, you know, from the heavenly cloud of witnesses. We, by the way, even though we're in our closing moments, we just had another call come in, and my curiosity is there to, I know we were closing out the show, but line 7818, first three digits, 458, you're live on the air. Who is this?
Hello, my name is Danae. You're talking to my mother, Lonnie, right now.
Wow.
Hi, Danae.
Well,
you need to talk to Danae. She worked with him as his videographer, and his she gave him, or he gave her assistant director credit on the film because she shared his vision so vividly.
Wow. Well, tell us about your experience with Ted, Danae.
Well, I didn't get to work with him for very long in his career. Specifically, I worked with him when he was making one of his later movies, which was the apartheid Slave Women's Rebellion, which it was very dear to his heart, though he always loved to make those movies with the very beautiful women and being very forceful. He was very interested in promoting the causes of people who needed a voice. And so it was an all female cast and crew, I believe 99% of the cast and crew were black women. And it was such a festive event. He was so celebratory of the women that were there and of their voices and of them being able to make this movie with him. And it was earthy and tribal, and it was so much fun. And he just kind of let himself get swept up in that and almost faded to the background, really, so that these women could start giving the voice to their characters and giving voice to this kind of anger they have over all of the treatment they'd had for all of this time, and kind of letting them take that out on him so that they could have a voice in the movie. And it was such a tribal, spiritual event to be at. It was just so feminine and so very Lilith Fair, even before that was a thing. And
yeah,
it was great.
Yeah, that film came out in 1997. And Ed said in the book, he said that he really enjoyed working with you on the film. And he said she was becoming an excellent camera operator. He was really proud of you.
He was, and he was amazing. He was so happy because, of course, this is a generational thing. He worked so much with my Grandma Tura, and then again with my mother, and then he was just so happy to keep working with our family. And he was amazing because he really let me have a lot of say in that and a lot of vision, and let the camera move to where it wanted to, and really trusted me with the craft. And that was amazing about him. He was always so encouraging of everybody. And when he saw a spark in someone, he trusted their vision.
Yes, in fact, he this on-the-job training, which I think with any art form, I mean, you know, you could read books about filmmaking all day long, but you've got to go out and shoot a film. And even in his film days, I remember Ted talking about corpse grinders, and we're talking about big film cameras, and his DP on corpse grinders was a rookie. And he talks about an embarrassing moment where the DP says real loud in front of the actors, "How do you load the magazines in this thing?"
Ted was a guerrilla filmmaker before guerrilla filmmaking was ever a thing. He was just like, we've got the bare minimum, we've got film, we've got a camera, we've got a couple of people with hands, let's go do the thing. And so that would happen a lot on his sets, where somebody would be really inexperienced, and you know what, he was never out of sorts. He was never angry, he was never a tyrant about it. He'd just come on over and be like, well, let's show you, you're going to need to know. And he was amazing in that way.
The movie that he did with you, too, that was a new step for him because it was his first film that he made on video.
It was a very interesting time for him, and he and I spent a couple of hours discussing, especially back in the time when we made it in 1997, there's no true black on video back then, and he was so frustrated by it. He's like, this is so annoying because here I am trying to make a movie for black women, and I'm trying to make it on video to save this money, and there's no true black on video. The color's all wrong. It was it was interesting to see him making that transition. And eventually he made his peace with the video, but at first just that cinema snob in him with that love of the celluloid, he couldn't let it go.
Yeah, and he sure kept up with the times. I mean, one of his last film that my dear friend Donna Lee was in, Paranormal, Text Messages from the Dead. You can't get a more modern technology theme than, you know, the dead are starting to text us.
Absolutely.
So Donna, I think you did Donna have a chance to say her last words? I think so, right?
I did, yes.
You did?
I did.
Okay.
And I'm going to be leaving now, but thank you. It was great speaking to everybody, and thank you again for the invitation.
This is Kevin, and I personally want to thank you for so much for your help on the book. I mean, you're called the Queen of Scream, they call you, but you were my angel. You came through winningly, and it's quite emotional when I think about how you helped me for the book.
God bless you, Donna.
It's emotional.
And God bless your lovely daughter, Danae.
Oh, I'm Lonnie's daughter.
Oh, that
daughter,
would be Lonnie's daughter. Yes.
Lonnie's daughter. I'm sorry. I just did a brain fart. Awesome. But God bless you, Danae, and God bless you, Donna, the two Ds, the dynamic duo for your remembrances.
Bless
here.
Bless you too, Donna.
Danae, we have to make a movie now.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
No, it's in the cards.
Know,
we need to make a movie.
Next time I'm shooting in Vegas, we've got to work together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I would be honored.
That would be delightful. I would love to work on something. Let's let's get together and work out a script.
Yeah, that'll be fun in honor of Ted. Well, before we go to the author of the book, I guess I think Donna's going now. Before we go to the author, Al, my co-host, what are your final thoughts on Ted V. Michaels?
Well, I was just wondering who should play him in a movie, like Johnny Depp played Ed Wood. Who should play Ted Michaels in a movie biography?
You know,
oh,
I
that's
never
an interesting
thought of
question.
He was such a one of a kind, unless you can put him in that cloning machine.
Right. You've got to really find somebody who can carry that mustache. That mustache had a personality of its own, and if they
yeah.
can't carry the mustache, they
and
can't carry the role.
That Bortos, there you go.
Right. No.
I have a final question just popping, rattling in my head as a person who does the same thing. I had an experience about a week ago. I got contacted. Some friends are like, oh, well, you must be doing really well. I see your DVD of your film in Walmart. It was a film I made called Sister Amy about a faith healer in the 20s, Amy Simple McPherson.
Right.
I didn't even know it was in Walmart, and I certainly, not knowing, didn't get any royalties. But I found, like, you know, there's an old saying, an artist gets their heart broken by the world, and I've had it happen so many times where I've made something that made money and got ripped off in the distribution or the selling or the, you know, and I put my own blood, sweat, and tears and money into it, and at times even with a wife and two kids, you know, losing our place because everything went into the movie. And, you know, just knowing the business side of it and how often the artist gets ripped off, and I don't know if it's too personal. Like, we've lost about 10 of our call-ins now as we're winding down that could have probably chipped in on this question and contributed. But just from the money standpoint, it seems like from people I know without mentioning any names that Ted ended up in some bad situations. You know, he left L.A. and came to Vegas, and I think someone reneged on a promise to help him in Vegas. But did he have a struggle just surviving financially, or how was he able to make it? Did he have profits from Corpse Grinders or some of the ones that did better, or was he ever in that position where he's like, how the heck am I going to survive financially?
He was always struggling to raise capital to do things. Yeah.
It was a labor of love, and he would throw every single penny and everything he had into his next movie, and then once it went out, he would go get a little bit under his feet and start all over again.
Yeah. Gary Clark, that appeared in his first movie in 1963, Strike Me Deadly, said Ted spent the last dime he had to make the movie. And you know what? That was his first movie. Ted did the same thing with all the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Struggle. How did he pay his rent or keep a roof over his head during all that?
I think there was always some money there. There must have. Maybe Donna Hamblin brought him some soup once in a while? No.
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of you listening out there that get discouraged, you filmmakers, that even the legends like this struggled. Vampira, who I'm sitting here with my co-host Al Doshna, did a beautiful film on Ed Wood's legacy called Haunted World of Ed Wood Jr. But Vampira, a friend of ours that was also in the 50s TV with her and had a voluptuous character, she would take food. I went to visit with her when she was dying. Voluptua was her name, and she was like, they would do the love movies, and then Vampire would play the horror movies. But when I was with her as she before she passed at her bedside, she said, you know, Richard, towards the end there, I would have to take casseroles to Vampire, or she wouldn't eat. You know, she'd take casseroles. And, I mean, this is a pretty sensitive subject, but just the reality is a lot of these great artists like Ted, who was true to his vision, they go through so much, and yet he was always upbeat. He always had a smile for everyone, you know. But he went through it, didn't he?
You know, one common theme for many of the actors I talked to was many of them got paid. They entered into agreements, and many of them worked for free. They actually did the films to help Ted.
Mm.
They loved him. They considered him family.
Mm.
Right. Greatness often comes in spite of circumstances that accomplishing certain things.
Amen.
Works of art.
Yes. We had someone pop back on at 435, first three digits, 586. Who is that?
That's Lonnie.
Lonnie, okay, so did you leave and come back?
I got disconnected. My dogs were romping.
Okay, well, welcome back, Lonnie. We were talking about how, as big of a legend as he was, that he put his life's blood and his money into each film, and it wasn't easy. And we were talking about the fact that sometimes it was down to his very dime into the film. And did you see that side of things, Lonnie, the struggle financially?
Yes.
Ted, and what were your thoughts about that?
That's actually why I called back, was because that was one of the things that Ted used to do. Ted would extend himself out on his credit cards, use one credit card to pay off other credit cards to try and keep afloat. And, you know, I know I used to try and help when I was staying at his place, you know, with whatever we could. You know, when Danae came in, she brought her skills and expertise, and she, you know, helped with what she could. We did a lot of side funding, trying to get investors and everything, but he was always going by just like on the skin of his teeth. And it was a struggle every single day trying to keep afloat and keep the vision alive. So...
And so much of his films were actually kind of a labor of love situation, where a lot of the services that he received were volunteer because he was beloved. And so people would volunteer their time to try to help him make the movie.
Yep.
Well, Kevin Collier, as the author of this great book, Kevin Scott Collier, why don't you close us out with your final thoughts? And thank you, by the way, everyone who called in today. We've had so many callers today. The lines were full, and we probably didn't even get everyone in. And we had, you know, a dozen or more lines all jammed up. So what a tribute to how beloved he was. But, Kevin, would you close us out with what's your thoughts on Ted V. Michaels? And maybe tell us again how to get the book.
Well, the book is on Amazon. It's titled The Life and Cinema of Ted V. Michaels. And he got to read some of it before he passed away. The book wasn't published until about 6 months after he passed. It was published on his birthday, in fact, the following his passing. And I previewed some chapters with him before he went away. But I want to thank all the wonderful people that I met and interviewed for this book, because the book, they tell the story. They hold the story. They have the content and the information and the history. Only them. And through them, they welcomed me. They invited me in. They provided wonderful material. So the book is only as good as the people who were involved in Ted's life. So I appreciate them beyond belief. And the one thing that really came out of it for me was, you know, I've lived 60 years so far, and that's as long as Ted made films or longer. And it's very unusual to live that long, 60 years for me, and not have enemies, not have people that talk you down or say bad things about you. Not the case with Ted. Everybody loved him, and they said so. And everybody, it almost was redundant, to the point where it was humorous, where I talked to an actor from the 60s and then one from the 80s and then one from 10 years ago, and they'd all say, well, Ted's like family. We hang out. I'm thinking, you know, this is generational. You people are all talking about the same man doing the same thing, acting the same way, and you love him. That is a testament to what a quality person he was and what a humanitarian he was and an influence on everyone. And I would just close out the book was a line that he spoke in his last movie, and Donna Lee was in this movie with him. It was Paranormal Extremes, Text Messages from the Dead from 2015.
And, yes, and by the way, listeners, this movie, go get it, because his performance is this older gentleman who misses his wife who's passed on. His performance is so endearing, and I just thought he was wonderful.
Yeah, he sits down on a park bench with the lead actress in the film, and he it's almost prophetic what he's talking about. It's almost he's seeing his own life. And what he said, he sits on the park bench next to this girl, and they're talking, and he's talking about his impending demise someday. And he says to the girl, he says, that big guy up there has it all figured out. He knows when it's time for you to slow down. But it's okay. We'll be together again someday. I know. I know it'll happen. It's just a matter of time. And when Ted speaks those lines in that film, look in his eyes. He's talking to us today. Mm-hmm. So part of paranormal extremes is this memory of something that wasn't paranormal but supernatural and blessed. And he was saying, I'll see you again someday, and I'll be just fine.
Beautiful. What a way to end the show. Thank you so much, Kevin Scott Collier. Thank you,
Richard.
To my co-host, Al. Thank you, those remaining on the line,
Al.
The lovely Lonnie and Danae. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Lonnie. Danae.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for letting us know.
Thank you, everybody, for remembering Ted.
Yeah.
Oh, you're most welcome. And thank you to all of you for listening today to Richard Rossi Live. This is a great show if you're listening and you have independent filmmaker friends. I think this is, there's something about biographies. I love biographies. And this has been like a radio broadcast, podcast biography of Ted. And in a sense, we could go on for 10 hours about Ted. But this is so inspiring and informative to those of you that want to make films. And for me as a filmmaker, it's very encouraging. The life of Ted V. Michaels is very inspiring to me to keep going. And it also, we didn't sugarcoat it. We talk about how hard it can be. And it's important for artists to know it's not easy. And you got to keep going and execute your vision, even with lack of funds and everything else. Well, Al, you've profiled Edward D. Wood Jr. in your film, and now you've been able to listen to a lot of recollections of Ted V. Michaels. I mean, as filmmakers listening, what do you think, and the artists listening, what do you think are kind of the lessons we learn from Ted V. Michaels?
Well, from listening to all the people that knew him, I think, just the scene that the author described, I think that's the most important thing, that, our relationship with other people, I mean, the physical things can come from that, but to me, I didn't know any of this about him, but just that sense of optimism and, connection with people, that they have a value that, and that just as kind of a side benefit, the films came out of that, but that was the most important thing. It seems to me.
So poignant. Well, thank you for listening to Richard Rossi Live, and thank you to IMDb for listening to the show the other day. It's now on there. Some of our celebrity guests on IMDb that have been a part of the show.